Welcome to the SAG-AFTRA Foundation's Conversations podcast. The SAG-AFTRA Foundation believes that contributions made to our culture by performing arts are not only valuable, but also essential. And so we provide free programming and services like this podcast to support them. If you'd like to learn more about the SAG-AFTRA Foundation or access the full library of our conversations or make a donation to support this podcast, please visit sagaftra.foundation. That's www.sagaftra.foundation. Also, subscribe to our YouTube channel and follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at SAG-AFTRA-Found. Thanks, and enjoy the conversation.
Welcome to the SAG-AFTRA Foundation and the Business Online Program. I'm an actor. My name is Bob Balaban. If you're interested in programming like this from the SAG-AFTRA Foundation, please consider liking this video and subscribing to our YouTube channel. And now it is my greatest pleasure to introduce producer Warren Littlefield. Hi, Warren.
Hello, Bob.
It's great to see you again. I haven't seen you for a couple of years.
I miss you, Bob. It's wonderful to see you. Thank you.
I'm glad we're almost here together. So Warren, in case you didn't know, is the founder and president of the Littlefield Company, whose shows have garnered so many Emmys, Golden Globes, and Producers Guild Awards, I can't count that high. Full disclosure, he's also a friend of mine. My wife and I met Warren sometime in the 70s and worked on developing a TV series that didn't happen, but we didn't hold it against him. I really didn't, Warren. But I don't remember much about that show. Do you have any memory of it? Do you even know what happened?
I think it was ahead of its time, Bob, and that was its flaw. I'm sure that you and I were on the cutting edge, along with Lynn, and the world wasn't ready for us.
Well, that's a really good way of putting it. I love that. Whether it's true or not, I don't know, but I like it.
Okay, good.
I'm going to batter you with a couple of easy questions. Where did you grow up, Warren? I never knew anything about your childhood.
I grew up in Montclair, New Jersey, in a very middle-class household. And my dad was a salesman for H.J. Heinz Company. We called him a pickle pusher. And my mom was a housewife, but uniquely, I grew up with both grandmothers in my home as well.
Wow.
So, and a sister. So a quiet dad and then all these women swirling in the household.
Well, how old were you when you knew you were hooked on show business? Do you have any memory of that?
I used to stay home a lot from school and I would be glued to the Million Dollar Movie coming out of WPIX in New York. And I think I felt very attached and that the world was more interesting in what I was looking at on the television set than sitting in a classroom. And I think my mom wanted company. So early on, I felt like there's something that's pulling me into that world, those wonderful movies, take me to a place. Let's see, Stanley Campbell came by one day and said, there's a rumor you're dead. And that's when I thought I probably should get back to school.
So you weren't sick. You just felt better staying at home.
Yeah. He said, I know you like staying at home, but you probably should they think you're dead.
Did you ever want to be an actor or a director? Did you ever go in that direction?
I did high school theater. And so I think that that's exactly as far as I was ever meant to be. A high school theater, I would not count on that ever being particularly good. But I love the process. I love being part of that community, and I love that putting on a show. And so that was exciting to me, but I don't think I was very good at acting.
Did you suspect you were ever going to go in the direction you went in, or was that a surprise for you, but actually deeply in the seeds of your youth, it sounds like it really took root?
Well, I think when I go back and look, that was where that core desire came from. But then, you know, it was the 70s. I went off to college, first in Washington, D.C., and got arrested at the May Day demonstrations, for which I got a credit in sociology. And then I transferred to a small school in New York State, Hobart and William Smith Colleges, and I got a degree in psychology. And that felt good, and that felt right for the times. And I got out of there, and I thought, okay, I need a break. I need to, like, have a work experience. And I had, I put myself through school being a Teamster, driving big rigs in the tri-state area.
Wow.
And yeah, it was great. And larger than life characters and a world. And I think it gave me a confidence that, like, I could do things. And so I got out of school with a degree in psychology and thought, let's just go to work for a while. And then I was really dismayed at what that looked like in New York. And an ex-girlfriend's dad had a small production company and said, hey, we're making this pilot. And if you want to be a gopher, you can be a gopher. And I was like, yeah, that seems like fun. And that was it. It was just, this is what I want to do. I want to be a part of making content that took me back to some of those high school acting roots, although I knew I should not be an actor. I don't have the skills and qualities that you possess, Mr. Balaban.
I think they're hiding in there. You just haven't found them yet.
Okay, you're being generous. I was infected by that creatively coming together with a team of people to make content.
Now, can you talk to me a little bit about The Last Giraffe and how I think it had something to do with bringing you to LA and NBC? Am I right?
I don't think that helped me get to NBC necessarily, but it got me out of New York into California. So it was a book about saving an endangered species. And I was like, all right, we can make this as a television movie of the week. I knew that we were competing against much bigger players in the landscape. So I sold it to advertisers, and then somebody, I'd never produced anything. And it's, they actually said, here's the money to go to East Africa, to go to Kenya and make a movie of the week. And it was wild and insane and fun. And, you know, we got a 35 share. It was a nice movie. It's a little movie, but I had done it. And then I had the opportunity to sell it throughout the world. And so that little production company that I'd worked for, Westfall Productions, that was the first time they had ever had profitability. And I think it was from that I was offered a job at Warner Brothers Television. And I went to work there in comedy development. And I stayed for 6 months. And then there was an opening at NBC. Stuart Cheslow was working there and said,
I remember him.
Yeah. He said, you should apply for this job. We have a job. There's an opening at NBC. And so I interviewed with Brandon Tartikoff, and I reviewed 4 episodes that had not gone on the air yet of The Facts of Life. And I don't know, I guess I said the right things. I don't know how qualified I was, Bob, but they took a flyer on me.
Well, you got to start somewhere.
That's it. And so NBC had Different Strokes and Hello, Larry. That was their comedy lineup. ABC had 14 comedies. CBS had a dozen, and they were outstanding. And so we started from nowhere, but it was a great learning tree because the cupboard was so bare at NBC. And so that allowed me to grow and to learn, and I guess couldn't have gotten any worse than where they were. So that was good timing.
And I guess Brandon Tartikoff was some kind of mentor for you. He was helpful. He taught you.
Yeah. And I think one of the great things that Brandon taught me was an absolute love of what we were doing. He was filled with a sly smile, glee over someone who was actually paying him to do this job. And it was a great job because that's where content happened. Being able to listen to ideas, generate them sometimes, and be able to say to writers, directors, producers, actors, go do it. And his love of the business was infectious. And I got to really appreciate how wonderful that experience could be through his eyes. It was a wonderful relationship.
Well, that's a great and unusual boss, as far as I can see.
Yes. He was demanding. We had to deliver. But there were gallows humor of like sitting in his office one night, the night that the A-Team premiered, and Brandon looked at myself and Jeff Sagansky, and he said, "If this thing doesn't open, we need to resign tomorrow." And I said, "Resign? Like, you mean give up our jobs?" And he goes, "We need to have dignity. They're going to fire us if this thing doesn't work. So we should be ahead of the curve." And I was like, "Do we all have to do that?" And of course, the A-Team worked, and we lived to fight another day.
And you were involved with some wonderful shows in the 80s. I think you had a lot to do with Cheers getting on the air. Am I right?
I was the junior guy on Cheers. It was my learning tree for comedy development. The Charles Brothers and Jimmy Burrows really kind of took me under their wing and said, "Watch what we're doing." Now, remember, there was no DNA at NBC for sophisticated adult comedy. It didn't exist on our network. And so Cheers went on. And at the end of the first year, it was the lowest rated show in all of network television.
Now, that's generally true of ensemble comedies. Am I right? It takes a while to catch on.
It takes time, even in that day and age when there were only three networks and networks ruled the world. But why would anyone who was watching NBC and NBC comedy ever expect that Cheers would be something that they would find there, right? So
right.
We had to educate an audience. So after they made the pilot, I was a development guy, but they said, "We'd like you to stay with the show." And that became the basis for, I think, my education and understanding of how adult comedy could work.
And a great beginning for your stream of years and years of great judgment and great shows.
Yeah, they fed me. I was smart enough to be hungry and listen. I could not have had better masters at the game. So I was very fortunate that I got to work with them.
How involved were you with finding Kirstie Alley and Ted Danson, and also one of the best ensemble casts I've ever seen?
Well, I was there for every casting session. We knew Fred Dreyer was kind of the real competition for Ted Danson. Fred was funny. He was good. But Jimmy Burrows said to us, I'm not sure day in and day out the range of what we want to do. He said, Fred is great, but the guy to go the distance is Ted. And we need all of his skills. And I think the lesson learned there was when you have a Jimmy Burrows and you have the Charles brothers, listen to them. And so there was a little bit of like, oh, Fred Dreyer. There was that buzz. And yet we listened to the wisdom of our producers and our director, our creators. And that was the right call. Kelsey came in and read, and he owned it. He was great. There was a lot of competition for him. And Kelsey Grammer was absolutely unknown, but there was something that was rather surgical in his ability to deliver Frasier, the voice of Frasier. We made a good call.
Now, do you like to audition actors? Are you comfortable with it? Because I know for a lot of producers and directors I know, they hate being in a room and anybody's auditioning, and I think they get nervous and scared. How do you feel about that?
It's exhausting. It's hard to go home at the end of the day and have a loved one say, how was your day? And you say, I'm exhausted. I sat in a room and watched actors perform. And they look at you and go, that doesn't sound like a tough day. I think if you're open and exposed, you know, I kind of, my process is to almost imagine for a moment right before the reading that there's been a scalpel that's literally gone right down vertically down my body and everything is open. And I try and feel as much as I can what's coming out of that performance. And it's interesting. I most often for me, when I'm leaning in, excited, turned on, completely captivated, I'm feeling that. And when I'm not feeling a performance, everything kind of shuts down for me. I like it. I think that it's a difficult process. I think the live in a room is kind of a crazy process. And I love that what we've turned that into now is we hire today so many actors who self-tape, or they go into reading sessions with a casting director, and it's basically sit and look at it. Many times we do callbacks, but the idea of walking into a room filled with executives where your life can change in that moment in that room, I think that that puts all kinds of burdens on the process that should not be.
I think one thing, I'm an actor and sometimes I'm directing people, and I think it's very easy for actors to forget that most people who are watching you at your audition are hoping and praying that you're the one and they can stop looking for other people.
Well, that's
hard to remember that.
It's absolutely true. It's the same thing when a writer comes in to pitch a show and you need to remind yourself that your network's future, your future can be when this creator opens their mouth, it may be the turnaround show for your network, right? And so are you going to be on top of your game and hear it and see it with an actor? Are you going to receive the gold that could possibly be there? And, you know, so much of what you do is go, no, you say no a lot. So you really have to be on your game and have, I think your antenna needs to be up for, you know what, there might be something wonderful here.
Well, it's great to have that attitude, and actors feel it when the people who are watching them are really caring. It's pretty magical when it's good.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Now, you orchestrated a or the renaissance at NBC, and you nurtured a never-to-be-seen-again state of through-the-roof hit series. And I'm going to mention a series, and you tell me anything you want to say about it. Okay.
All right.
It's sort of like 20,000 questions. Seinfeld, go.
Seinfeld. One of the few memories from my history of NBC is right up here behind me, and I've always kept this close by. It's the original research report from the Seinfeld Chronicles. And overall evaluation, weak. The test audience hated it. They knew who Jerry Seinfeld was. They just didn't like the show. And they said, these people are awful human beings. And so for the final night of filming of Seinfeld, I took original copies of the research report and I got the cast to sign it and Larry David. And I keep it framed to remind myself that it's not painting by the numbers. Right. Breaking rules, doing things that scare you are really important. Failure is really important to understand when you've gone too far and the audience rejects. What's important is not to fail all the time, but to learn from your mistakes. And Seinfeld just broke all the rules. I remember saying to Larry for the Chinese restaurant episode, there's no story. Don't want a story. And Larry was so offended. And you've played cards with Larry. You know Larry.
Well, yeah.
And yet, what Jerry said is, they may not get what we're trying to do with this episode, but they're letting us do it. And that was the wonderful yin and yang of that team is Jerry believed that the glass was half full and Larry thought that it was empty. And
not even half empty.
Yes. And together they made brilliance. So that was... And they broke all the rules of storytelling in a half-hour comedy.
Yes, a show about nothing.
Show about nothing, as you, Bob Balaban, standing in yet again for me in memorable episodes of Seinfeld. I love it.
Well, I was on the last episode of the first season, and I think somebody said to me, this show is in 86th place. For how many people were watching it.
Yeah.
And I came back and went home and nobody noticed me or thought about it. You know, I didn't hear about anything. I was on a couple of episodes the next season. And I believe it was you who decided to change the night and the time. And immediately you were in the top 10. Am I wrong?
You are correct. Larry, I said, well, we were losing Cheers. I think the important thing here is that the lesson learned in Cheers is we believed in it. And it wasn't about the ratings. It was about what are you going to stand for? What are you going to believe in? And Grant Tinker helped instill that quality in us. Respect the audience. Good things will happen. And so the lesson learned in Cheers was then applied to Seinfeld of, do we love this? We do. Do we have anything better than this? We do not. So that's it. Keep it going. And so then when I said to Larry, well, look, Cheers is leaving. I'm going to put you on Thursday night. And Larry's like, well, if they didn't watch us when we were on Wednesday getting a 19, I don't want those people. They don't deserve us.
That's so Larry.
It's so Larry. We, in the final season of Cheers, we put Seinfeld behind it. And so you're now in the countdown to those final episodes of Cheers. Seinfeld just went in for that final run, and they eclipsed in the numbers, they eclipsed Cheers. And that's where Jimmy Burrows called me and said, I don't think we wanted this to end, but I think maybe it is time. And look what they just accomplished with Seinfeld. They surpassed us.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing.
How about Friends? What was
that? How about Friends? Yeah. Well, we had been playing with that target for a while. We wanted to do that experience of a young adults leaving the nest of family and being out on their own. And the whole idea was that if you were doing it with someone else, maybe it would be a little easier. Wow, we developed the number of scripts that were awful and never made a pilot. But we believed in that target. So when Mark Kaufman and David Crane came in and said, this is our story. And it was hilarious. They had a tremendous vision and we were smart enough to say yes. It started, that was a high week in testing. But young adults got it. They immediately understood the sensibility. And so we put it on Thursday night and the rest was history. A brilliantly executed soap opera that was wildly funny.
And were the friends actually friends? I always wanted to know.
Yeah, they were. They loved each other. You know, we had done a few pilots and a short-lived series with Jennifer. When we went out into the marketplace with that script, the town went crazy. They sensed out there, and it's the first kind of indication when you're in the casting process of whether you have something.
Right.
And agents were, you have to see, I have this young client. And, you know, unlike other networks that banked more on familiar names and established stars, we really like the idea that television makes stars and that there's a sense of discovery. And so the idea that we had this bright, fresh, young, funny ensemble of young adults, and they immediately bonded, and Jimmy Burrows did the pilot, brought them all together, and Martin and David understood how to write something that was wildly entertaining and emotionally compelling.
Wow. How did you get such great chemistry? Did you test the actors with each other? How did it come to be that there were so many wonderful relationships, and they weren't always even written into the parts? They just had great relationships.
We were lucky. We were lucky. They read individually. You know, they read individually. Once we shot the pilot, and Jimmy was so good about creating a safe environment where they could bond. And then we shot the pilot, and then Jimmy flew them all on a private jet to Vegas.
Wow.
And said, you'll never be able to do this again. And we're just going to have a night playing in Vegas. That'll be that. And it exploded. I mean, a little bit of time to catch on, but it exploded and it became the monster, the most successful comedy in the history of comedy throughout the world. It's generated more viewers, more income. Nothing has surpassed it.
I remember David Schwimmer's mother doing something for the cast that I was never sure if it was apocryphal or real, but am I right? That she made it, she convinced everybody's agents that everybody should get the same money?
Well, she was a powerful divorce attorney, and she had a lot of wisdom, but it wasn't really his mom who was carrying that water, it was David.
Oh.
David came out of a theater background in Chicago, and David believed that regardless of that, they came into the show at different levels. You know, deals were made based upon who they were or who they weren't at that time. And when it was clear that it was a big hit and the idea was let's redo these deals and get more years for the show, David said, we'll never survive what's happening in our lives with this unless we're equal. And it's an ensemble, and that's how we need to be treated. And it ended up being not only the right thing to keep them together for a decade, but it ended up being a brilliant strategy because, of course, the business people at Warner's and NBC, you always pick people off and therefore make a deal and then say, well, we have so-and-so. And it, they were united. They had to be treated as one, and their ship rose accordingly. They deserved it all, but every one of those cast members walked away being, in, let's just say, enormously wealthy.
Wow.
And that all goes back to that strategy that David had, because multiple times they were able to renegotiate for that.
And the power of negotiation when the entire cast is negotiating is real power.
Muscle, absolutely. And a hit show. And then Marta and David also understood that the reason that they had a hit was because of that cast. And so none of them had back-end points when they were hired. And throughout several renegotiations, Marta and David shared. They shared so that they were truly partners and, you know, life-changing differences for all of them.
I think Marta was a babysitter for my kids when she was very young in acting school.
Was she good at that?
Yeah, she was great. Oh, I never forgot it.
Oh, good. I love that.
How about Frasier?
Well, you know, I was scared to death. The only thing that when I was, you know, had gotten the big job at NBC to run the entertainment division, the only thing that still was alive on that schedule was Cheers. And then Ted said, it's been great and it's time to go. And so I was desperate to have something come out of Cheers. And, you know, there was talk about, well, should it be a spinoff for, Cliff and Norm, right? A Cliff and Norm spinoff.
Right.
And at the end of the day, we thought that the character that had weight and could really be the center of something, not delightful, brilliant, comedic sidebar, but who could carry us. We really felt that that was Frasier and Kelsey. And so wonderfully, Casey, Angel, and Lee created a family comedy. And they said, we know if it's in Boston, you're going to make us do episodes back at the Cheers bar. We'll never have our own identity. We're going to Seattle. We're going as far away as we can.
Right.
So that you won't be tempted. And I was like, fair enough. And so they constructed a wonderful adult sibling, two brothers having to figure out how to deal with their retired dad. And when it was pitched, we had the cast done in the pitch. We knew exactly who we wanted, what we wanted to do, and just went out and executed it. And that was a magical night. And I felt on stage that night that maybe I could hold on to my job because Frasier was going to be a pretty wonderful comedy and that I could survive losing Cheers.
Now, it sounds like in a way you built the show around Frasier and the actor. Do you often or do you ever find an actor that you love so much and have no idea what you're going to do with him and build something around him or her? Does that happen?
I think usually what you fall in love with talent, I do all the time. But I think it's also finding what's the creative thrust? What do you want to say? What is it? Where does it want to live? So I think it's more about what goes hand in hand is, it's really finding a path that sets you in motion. That you need the North Star as well as the talent.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you have the same casting director for years, or did it change? And who was your casting director? I don't remember the NBC casting director.
Well, for Cheers, it was Joel Thurm. And then shortly after that, Joel left and Laurie Openden was running casting for NBC for more than a decade and brilliantly guided us through so many of those must-see TV shows. And really always encouraged me to take chances. I trusted her instincts. When I doubted mine, I listened to her. And then after a long run at NBC, then she went and discovered a whole new generation of talent for the CW network and did that for a decade and recently retired.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And wow, she was a career maker.
That's a great boon for a network to have somebody with that kind of taste and somebody you like and agree with, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Magical. Brilliant.
Now, were you aware of casting directors at other networks? Did they do things the way you did it, or was NBC unique in discovering new talent?
I think because we liked that sense of discovery, I think we were somewhat unique. CBS was always more traditional and went for more names. And they had an older audience and they catered to that. I'm not as aware of any of our competition. I think we liked what we were doing and focused on doing that well. And so that's kind of where we lived.
Now, in 1998, in your final year, oh, by the way, did Law and Order begin under your leadership?
Yes, Law and Order did. And then Dick Wolf pitched me a show called Sex Crimes. And I was like, okay, we're an advertiser-supported network. I won't be able to get any advertisers into that. But I think you do have a really interesting idea here. And here's what we're going to do. We're going to make it Law and Order, : Sex Crimes or whatever it goes, and that became SVU. And that's a way to use that brand that we've now established, Dick, and that became the, and I apologize for this, but that became the birth of the procedural spinoff in network television. So it all worked for Dick.
Isn't Law and Order still on the air, a version of it? Am I wrong?
Yes, no, that's still on. Absolutely.
What is that, 23 years?
More. Yeah.
My God.
Yeah.
Now, also in your last year, The West Wing began. How did that happen? Did you create it? Did somebody come to you with a germ of an idea? How did it happen?
Out of the tremendous success from ER with John Wells, I didn't want to lose John Wells to competition. So I made a pretty big commitment. And under that commitment, John brought in Aaron, and Aaron had his experiences in the West Wing. And that was it. They were sat on the couch and they pitched the show. And we were just smart enough to go, okay. And Aaron wrote it, wrote a few drafts. And one of the last moves I had before I got my exit visa from NBC was I put all the deal together to go forward. And one of my final battles with Don Ohlmeyer was I said, we're making this. And I'm president of the entertainment division and I get to make that call. And he was like, it'll never work. I don't want to do it. And so we had quite a heated debate, and not long after I was gone. And then when a new administration came in, that was one of the first thing they did was they fired it up. But it was my development. So I take pride in that. And it was one of the reasons why I was asked to leave.
Wow. I never knew that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But did you ever dream that you would be responsible for so many successful shows for so long? Did you used to sit around thinking about it, or were you too busy to even think?
I was kind of too busy to think. And I think you don't, the last thing you want to do is to buy into your own bullshit. I think that as a network programmer, it's always about, well, that's great. And I would champion, you know, on a Thursday night in the 90s, a third of the country was watching NBC. 75 million people watched NBC on a Thursday night. So that was pretty remarkable. And we felt really good about quantity and quality. That was great. But, you know, you always have, there's always holes to fill. There's always so much more. And you're slumped over going, but how are we going to fix Friday? And then, of course, GE owned us, and GE showed me a chart, and they said Thursday night is more profitable than all the other nights combined. And I said, how about that? We do a really good job on Thursday. And they go, no, you missed the point. You need more Thursdays. And I go, that's your point? You just want me to deliver more Thursdays. I was like, okay, thank you for the wonderful meeting.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know that you would say this about yourself because you don't brag, but why do you have such good managing skills? I've worked with a lot of people. You're easygoing, you're tough, you're smart. You don't do anything quirkily or just to be different. You actually are very centered. And I've never seen you get mad. I'm sure you do occasionally, but it's not much in your vocabulary.
Yeah.
What was in your background that best prepared you for this kind of skill at management? How did it happen?
Well, you know, thank you. Thank you for those comments.
Well, it's true. And, you know, when I was cast in the HBO movie, The Late Shift, I wanted to study you. So I think you told me this. You said I could sit in your office in the back and be quiet and watch you interviewing and working with other people. And it really taught me a lot in your calmness and the straightforward nature of it. And I think I scared people too by watching.
I think you probably did. I think part of it was growing up in that household with a number of women. And I respected and listened to them. And so I never thought that, as a male, somehow I should be dominating. I think that I should be listening. And that there was respect. And then I studied psychology. You know, I had a degree in psychology. And I think my learning to work with other people is really about appreciation. And I think as a network guy, and then also as a producer, my job is to have my eyes open to find vision. And I don't have to have the vision, but I need to be able to identify it. And then when I identify it, I need to nurture it and I need to protect it. And so I've gotten to this place in my life where companies are willing to give me lots of money where they make bets on what I can make because they see that I'm able to take that vision and then build with a number of other visionaries around it and put something cohesive together that audiences value. And so that's not being the loudest voice in the room. That's listening, understanding, and finding community of artists. That's really satisfying to me. I mean, I like that. I don't need the Klieg light to be on me. You know, from time to time, it's great. You know, I don't mind walking on stage and being able to hold an Emmy. But the process for me I think is about listening, finding, protecting, nurturing, and then pushing that forward.
Well, it's the kind of thing that can't really be taught, but it's, I think it's one of the biggest reasons that you had so much success so early on in your career. And in the, even in the last 20 years, you've continued to have a vibrant career. And there really, you can count on one hand how many people had a career for their whole lives and are still having one.
And I'm just trying to keep up with Norman Lear.
Yes. But I, who was I talking to? Maybe Norman Lear a little while ago. He said, I did all these great shows and I want to do a show about a retirement home. And everybody tells me I'm too old and it can't be done. And yet it was a great idea. And he's still going.
At 100, he's still out there doing what he loves to do. He's amazing.
Now, Handmaid's Tale. That's a wonderful show and an unlikely show. I can't imagine how you got it on the air, except it's because with the world is a little bit different now. People are willing to accept unusual things. How did it happen? And is it unusual to adapt a book to be a series? Have you done that before?
Well, Fargo was, of course, adapting a movie. But Handmaid's Tale, MGM had developed a script with Eileen Chaikin, and they had sold it to Showtime, and Showtime passed. MGM went into the marketplace and said, anybody interested? And Hulu said, we're interested in adapting Margaret Atwood's book. We think that that could be a really interesting proposition, but we want to start from scratch, and we'll order two scripts, and with those two scripts, we either go to series or not, and so that's where MGM went. And then, you know, of course, in trying to find the writer to adapt it, it was actually Hulu and MGM that said, we know Bruce Miller is the wrong sex, and his career is not hot, but he has an inspired take on what to do with it. And so the least sexy candidate to adapt The Handmaid's Tale was Bruce Miller. And wow. they said, let's do it. Now, also, they didn't have this massive penalty over them. So I think it's critical to their brilliance is that there was no punishment attached. It was just creatively, are we going to take a leap? Are we going to try? Because we heard from this writer a vision and we liked it. And it was better than anybody else we auditioned. And so they did. And then they wrote two scripts. And then they wanted Lizzie Moss.
How did they know about her? Had they worked with her before?
They hadn't worked with her, but of course, Mad Men, Lizzie's star had risen throughout the arc of that series. And they coveted her. And then Lizzie's reps, were like, yeah, well, they're not getting Lizzie Moss. And so I had just recently gone to WME, and so Ari Greenberg at WME said to Lizzie's WME reps, well, what if I brought the guy who did Fargo? And Sharon Jackson, was a part of Lizzie's life, And Ari knew that Fargo was like her favorite show. And so basically they said, okay, Warren, call Lizzie Moss. She's doing a limited series in Australia. You get on the phone with her and convince her that you are her partner in doing this. And by the way, make sure she doesn't get director approval. And so I'd never met Lizzie. We spent a few hours on the phone And I said, look, I'm prepping another Fargo, and I don't have to do this, but I think Bruce captured something that's pretty powerful. And if you do it, I'll be there for you, right? I will be there late at night and early in the morning. And because I think this is worth fighting for. And so if you do it, I'll do it. And Lizzie said, I think we have to do it. I think I'm going to be really upset if I don't do it. And I want your help in putting this together. And I said, great. Now, about that director thing. And I said, look, I'm never going to hire a director without your approval. Nobody wants to put it in the contract. So this is the first test. Will you trust me? And she said, yes. And that's it. Then it's become a wonderful triangle of trust with Lizzie Moss, Bruce Miller, and myself. And as we often say, we wish that the show is no longer relevant.
Right.
And sadly, it becomes more and more relevant each and every year.
Well, so, her agents must have been pretty happy with the way it turned out after wanting her not to do it, right?
Yeah. It's been a phenomenal story. And Lizzie's turned into being a hell of a director. She directed 3 of the 10 episodes this year. Season 4, she directed 4. I believe that she deserved that opportunity, and she seized it.
But don't you think she's the kind of an actress who can actually do anything? She can be funny. She can be sexy. She can be any. She can be anything. But I didn't know that until I saw this show.
Yeah, it's so true. I never count out Lizzie Moss. She does the work, whether it's preparing for her scene for the next day as an actor, whether it's prepping as a director. No one else does the legwork for her. She's there. She's present day after day, night after night. An amazing creative work ethic.
And she didn't audition for this part, right? She just, you guys just talked.
Yep. Yeah.
Was that a little scary for you, or could you tell in your heart?
Yeah. The moment we shot the first scene with her, and the camera intimately came into her face, and she had no dialogue. It was just what she was telling us with her face as she sat backlit in that window seat in the attic room. And I was just like, yeah, this works. Zero doubt. And then it was when we looked at the first cut, the first assembly. Yes, we knew going in that Lizzie was going to work. It was just creating this dystopia that all of that would work, because MGM had done a really bad movie in the early 90s. And
of the book?
Yeah. And lots of bad decisions. But we looked at that early cut and said, this feels powerful. I'm connected to June and June's journey. And if June doesn't give up against these overwhelming odds, then that gives me the strength to carry on and to watch that journey with her.
Well, there's your psychology coming back again, right?
Yeah, maybe.
And you've just wrapped production, I believe, on The Old Man for FX.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you roped in Jeff Bridges, who'd never done a TV series, as far as I know, right?
That's right. Yeah. The last television he did was when he was a teenager, just doing a little walk-on thing with his dad's show. But it had been over 50 years that he appeared on television. And You know, I took the Thomas Perry book, and I believe that there was a wonderful setup of basically what's it like to be Jason Bourne 30 years later? And it was a guy living in Vermont with his two dogs, and his past was going to come back to haunt him. And he was going to be on the run and fight for his life, and don't count him out. And so that setup we loved. I went to John Steinberg, the only writer I went to, and said, here's the potential, and I think we can deepen this and open it up. I see a series here. We actually spec'd the script. We wrote the script. And then with the script, we said, who would be our dream? Like, if we could have anyone in the world, who would it be? And we're like, well, Jeff Bridges would have to be the top of the list. And then I started engaging with Jeff's reps and everyone. And then we had something to show them, right? And we started a long dance. And Jeff said, look, I paddle my boat down the river, and I only occasionally pull off to the side for a little stop for where I'm very happy just paddling my boat down the river. And he said, but this is pretty good. And so we engaged a number of times with Jeff and said, so this is what it looks like. This is what doing a series looks like. And he felt comfortable and safe. And so we then had Jeff Bridges. We had the script for the first hour and a vision of what the series would be. And John Landgraf read it and said, we're making this series.
And did you bring in John Lithgow at that point? Because they're so great together. From what I read about it,
yeah,
it was very helpful with Jeff.
Yeah, I'd done Third Rock from the Sun with John Lithgow and love him, and we needed someone from Jeff's past, right? Dan Chase's past, who could challenge him and duel with him. And so much of that in the early episodes is they're never in a scene together. They're on the phone. So they're never working together. So when we finally put them together, it was insane. It was such a love story. And of course, the story of Old Man it took 2.5 years to do 7 episodes. We were shut down by COVID for 6 months, and then Jeff got cancer. And then with cancer treatments, he then contracted COVID, and we nearly lost him. It was very touch and go. And so he made it. And so imagine a soulful man like Jeff Bridges having survived COVID, cancer, and we come back to work to finish. We did a shortened season instead of 10, we did 7. And it was such an incredible experience to be all back together again. 90% of the crew from 2.5 years earlier came back. They just wanted to be a part of it. And it was magical. And so our partners, who could have written the whole thing off, there were lots of discussions about, will this be a write-off? Will it ever come back to life? They were patients, and then we put it out there, and our patients, their patience was rewarded, because it was, we ended up numbers that FX hasn't experienced in a decade on the linear network, and also an explosion on Hulu as well. So, patience rewarded for good partners. And I just heard the pitch out for season 2 today.
Wow.
Yeah.
I love the show, and I'm so glad there's going to be more of it. I can't wait to see it.
Thank you.
So what's it like to work with your son in your company? Was he there from the beginning? No, he probably wasn't old enough.
Well, Graham came out of SC and then he USC in communications, and then Graham navigated to acting, and so he was doing a acting school in a 3-year program, and then he was out from time to time, like getting a role here, a role there. And he was in that early baby steps. And I'd said to him, so, I believe in you. And if this is what you want to do, then that's fine. I also want to mention, though, that you know, when I'm out there in the marketplace, I'm at Hulu, I'm at FX, I'm at all these places, and I'm seeing a community of young people who love this medium. And they're no more articulate, they're no more passionate about the medium than you are. The difference is they have a job and they have community. And I'm not here to be critical of your choice of being an actor, but I think you thrive off of community. And I wonder if you should also consider, you know, some of the, because every time I would go to Hulu, you would go, now don't forget, when you go there, ask to see so-and-so because I went to school with her and she's one of my good friends, and make sure you say hi. And everywhere I would go, like Graham knew people. And I said, well, does this make sense? So I made that little mini speech, and he said, you know what? I think you're right. I'm going to start working for you next week.
Wow.
And I said, well, no, I actually thought that you should. Yeah. And he said, no, I'm going to come work for you. And what's wonderful is he doesn't listen to me. He's very opinionated. He does. He's really great eye for actors. Really understands and can identify who's right in what role. Great understanding of directing. And now we get to have adventures together. Last week we were in Berlin prepping for a new dramatic show that we're doing for FX called The Bends. And so I was running around day and night scouting locations in Berlin with him. And I gotta say, it's a pinch me experience. He still doesn't listen to me at all. But I kind of love that. I don't need to be surrounded by people that listen to me.
Does he remind you of yourself a little bit?
He's a stronger version of me. Oh. He's more decisive, has stronger opinions than I do. I came to it slowly. I think he has a better background in all of it than I did.
Right.
You know, and so I slowly, out of making lots of mistakes, I slowly got more confident and understood where I wanted to come from, what I wanted to do. And I think he just, he found that a lot faster than I did.
Well, he had you to pattern after too.
Well, maybe. I'll take a little credit, not too much.
Now, you're still happily married, I believe, to your wonderful wife of many decades.
Yes, over 40 years together. We met on the DeKalb bus commuting from New Jersey into our jobs in Manhattan. She has nothing to do with the business. She's a horse whisperer. And has a very dusty, dirty existence and loves that she works with animals.
How great that you're not in the same business. I think it's very hard when a couple is in the same profession.
I think it's unique.
I don't think it's easy.
I think that's right. And I think navigating all of that is difficult. She's a passion for and pride in what I do and Graham does. But yes, there's no competition.
What's next?
What's next? Well, I just teased you with
Berlin.
With Berlin, yes. The first hour will be Sardinia and then Berlin. So yeah, that's kind of wonderful. Family drama, but also a crime thriller that examines at a higher level the corruption of international banking and what that's doing to destroy the world that we live in. So I'm very excited about that. We just finished this week. We finished Handmaid's Five. Next week, I'll be in Calgary prepping Fargo Five.
Wow!
And we just have the story broken for The Old Man Two. We're doing things that we believe in, that we love. Emmys are coming up, so let's hope that
special basket to the show.
Yeah, let's hope that Dope Sick gets the appreciation that I think it deserves. So far, with 14 nominations, we're honored to have that kind of love and support
and fantastic reviews, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, really, really outstanding. And you know, it's kind of it's what I said to Hulu is HBO learned when they put Chernobyl on that despite that really, really tough story to tell, that audiences came to it because they wanted to understand it. They wanted to understand what happened.
Right.
And it was brilliantly executed. And so HBO knew they were doing something great. They just didn't know that that many people would watch it. And they did. And then they got great awards and accolades. And I said, look, that was the most important story of its era. And they brought that to life. This is the story of our time. And that's what we need to and want to do. And God bless Hulu. They said, make us proud. I think with all the awards we've received and a Peabody, and it would be great, the Klieg light that we could potentially get at an Emmy only says to more people in a world of infinite content and massive amounts of great choices, you know what, maybe I should check that out. I think the more people that see it understand the mistakes that were made and appreciate that we need to give dignity and honor that the victims, it's not their fault. They were abused by a corrupt system. And that's important to share with the world. So I'm hoping that we get even more Klieg lights coming up in September and that more people see it, because I think it's an important project to be seen.
Well, you've never done anything the same twice. You find constantly different, interesting situations and characters. But is there something in common when you get excited about something? Is there a core reason that helps you choose what to do? Is there something that you look for?
Well, our job, I think, is to entertain. But I also am not afraid of enlightening. There are other companies that will certainly do more volume. We try and go quality first. I've done content that's consumed by masses, and that's exciting. That's great. I just think it's quality first right now. And so I ask myself, would I want to watch that? Your biggest upside is if you can step into something that other people are not doing, that it separates itself. It's a fog cutter, right? In a world of infinite choice. And so those are the kinds of things I look for. And also artists with vision. I want to work with people that make me feel like I'm still growing as an artist.
Right.
You know, I try and surround myself with people who are far more talented than I am. And that makes it exciting for me. And then I think, you know, corporations believe that I will be responsible with their money. So they give us trust. They give us massive amounts of money to mount these productions. And we do that responsibly and we do it well. And I like that trust and I like that relationship that we have. But they go. I mean, it's Hulu saying, make us proud, right? I can't ask for more than that. You know, I had Jordan Hellman, who is the lead developer and programmer at Hulu for original content. And, you know, we were about to go forward on something. And Jordan said, I'm not sure I see this director doing this. I really don't get it, but I'm afraid to say no to you. And I said, Jordan, you're our partner and you absolutely can say no. What I prefer is to figure out if I can connect with you on why we're so excited that this director can bring this to life. That's what I want to try and have happen. So let's engage in that. And then, you know, you may use your veto or you may not. And ultimately he did. And he's like, you have to make sure that this artist is a part of the series. And I was like, yes, because you bet on them. Yes, that's what we'll do. And I think we love that. Like, that's the most exciting thing, is when it's not tried and true. And by the way, I bow to the experience of Jeff Bridges, John Lithgow, Michael Keaton. But it's also exciting when you put John Hookenauer in Dopesick, and people go, who's that guy?
Are you ever going to write another book? What do you think?
It's a lot of work. Oh, I would only do it if you would do the audio version, Bob, which I continue to be indebted to you for always. But I don't know. It's when I sold the book, I was like, this is fun. And it's hard. It's a lot of work. So
it was really fun reading it, I have to tell you.
Thank you. I don't know. I like right now what's on my plate and what I'm doing. I don't think I have time. So we'll see. I never say never. But right now I'm loving what I'm doing and my plate is pretty full. And I also love that.
If you could adapt any movie in the world, what movie would you adapt?
So I was crazy enough to do Fargo, right? Where all my friends said, bad idea. But I think what would be fascinating would be to take the French Connection and do, it's really the origin story of drug trafficking in America. And go to Marseille, go open that up and tell that story of how that French cartel changed life for so many people here in this country. So I love the size, scope, and what that could be. Again, brilliant movie. Maybe it's crazy to touch it, but opening it up and finding, and I've read the original book that it was based on, opening that up, that could be fun.
Sounds like a good idea to me. And it's also another thing, you've never come close to doing anything like it.
Yeah.
I like it.
All right. Thank you.
Well, Warren, it's been wonderful picking your brain and talking to you. Thank you. And I'm so glad we got to see each other because it's been forever.
It has been. And I love you. I admire you. I really cherish our friendship. And thank you so much, Bob, for being so generous with your time and grilling me tonight. I loved it.
Well, I loved hearing you. It was great. And it was the most we've ever spoken to each other in one sitting. So hooray for that.
Hooray for that, indeed.
Thank you for listening to the SAG-AFTRA Foundation's Conversations podcast. If you appreciated what you heard, please support us with a review or donation and reach out to us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at SAG-AFTRA Found. We'd love to hear from you.